Accession number 15538, reel 2.
Okay. Well, we left Egypt and went down to 211 Squadron at in the Sudan, and at a place called Wadi Gazouza. It was a training unit on Blenheims, and we were posted there as instructors. But we applied every week to get onto an operational squadron, and we made, kept on all the time. And eventually, on the way down, that was it, from Egypt down to the Sudan, we went down by boat, the river boat, the flat-topped affair that goes down the paddle steamlet, and that was quite interesting. And on the way down in the train to Shalal, where we picked up the boat, Todd Slaughter, this chum of mine, we had a few beers on the way, and we got aboard the boat, and we wondered what to do. It was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So we had a good look round and all this sort of thing, and then explored. And then I said, well, don't you think it would be a good idea if we had a look at what's on top of the flat roof, which goes right down the boat? The only thing projecting from it was the captain's bridge, which was well forward. And so he said, yes, that was a good idea. Well, we couldn't go up on the captain's bridge, of course, to get up there. So we shinned up outside on the stanchion things and got up on the flat roof that way. And in the middle of it was a Lewis gun on its standing. And there it was with its tarpaulin thing over it and its case of ammunition by the side of it. And so I said, well, these things never work. And old Todd said, no, I shouldn't think they do. So anyway, just to have a look at it, I took the cover off the tin, which, well, I say the tin, but it was a metal container, and opened it up, and there were these rounds of... So I took one out and took off the thingamy and put it in position on the gun and double-cocked it and got clear and turned it to one side and said, well, we'll see, it'll never work. And so I aimed it at the far shore, squeezed the trigger, and to my absolute horror, of course, the thing went off. And it fired, I think it was 10 shots, actually, before I... Anyway, of course, the chap on the bridge came rushing along and so on, and there was a squadron leader on board, and he more or less took over. I was a flying officer at the time, or we both were. But it was my fault, of course. I'd done it all. And he said, well, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm armament officer from the headquarters Middle East Air Force, and I'm out doing spot checks, you see, on these things to make sure they work. So he looked a bit sideways at me, but anyway, he said, I see. And the captain of the boat said, I'd like your name and this, that and t'other. And I said, yes, I told him. And that was fine. And we then got off down where they built the dam now.
Aswan.
Yes. Or did we go as far as Khartoum? I can't remember. But anyway, I think it was Khartoum, yes. And then we caught the train from there up towards Port Sudan and where Wadi Gazouza was. And this was a rather amusing part of it. We went to the station headquarters because we'd spent two or three days in Khartoum. We thought we may as well while we were there. And so the squad, we went out there, went to the SRO's office, station administrative officer, to report. And who was it but this squadron leader who came down on the boat with us, who had taken my name and all this sort of thing, and I told him this load of rubbish. And he is a very nice chap indeed, because he said, I think we've met before, haven't we? And I said, yes. And he said, oh, and he didn't refer to it. He just grinned a bit, and he didn't refer to it at all, which was very nice. But I did get an official letter sent to me there, saying that I owed, and I can't remember how much it was, but I owed so many piastres for using unofficial use of this ammunition.
Did you pay it?
Yes, I did. I'm not all bad. Anyway, that was that. And we then went out to 45 squadrons, and we went up to Egypt again. I forget how we went up to Egypt, but anyway, I don't know, maybe it may have been by boat. No, it wasn't by boat. I must have flown out there, that's it. And I was posted out to 45 squadron in India. We went by sea, but I can't remember how the deuce we did go. We went by sea, and from there we went by sea again out to India. And that was as 45 squadron personnel. We went out to join 45 squadron. They'd come in from the desert and with all their aircraft, and the aircraft were being flown out by junior pilots and crews for practice on the way, and those of us so-called experienced blokes went out by sea. And we caught it was a freighter again, and it had, we went as a squadron, but the squadron had to be wholly self-supporting, food, cooking, everything. And so we well, I didn't, but I mean the cooks and chaps on the squadron had out of doors cooking things in the well decks of this freighter. We had no rain, of course. I mean, we sailed round Calcutta with that, and the worst part of it was going down the Red Sea, because at that time of the year, which was, well, I think it was July or August, but the prevailing wind was northerly, and we were sailing south, and the smoke from a funnel just went vertically up into the sky, and we just sat there and stewed absolutely from, well, we went down to Aden, and I met all the chaps down there again, and we had a bit of a party. Then we went on to Ceylon. We had 3 days in Ceylon, and then we went round to Calcutta. When we got to Calcutta, we were going to then rejoin the squadron at Mingledon in Burma, and we were told when we got to Calcutta we would be off the next morning. We would go by train, we'd go overland to Mingledon, and that was it. Well, the next morning came, and the next morning came, and the next morning came, and we wondered what the deal was happening, because we were just sitting there. It was all very nice, but you know, it wasn't really what we were there for. And then suddenly we got the news that the whole squadron aircraft had been written off on the ground by Jap fighters at Mingledon. There was just no fighters there, no aircraft, no aircraft at all.
What had they been equipped with?
Blenheims, Blenheim 4s. And that was... and then followed this year of well, it was an unhappy year. I did various jobs, including but during the March and May, that's right, of I was sent over to Burma as officer ICRAF detachment at Michinaha, and our duties. Sorry, I've just touched the microphone.
That's all right,
don't worry. Oh dear, oh dear. we were evacuating the troops by air. Number 30 and 31 squadron were doing it. And we had I had the signals unit there, which of course was run by an old warrant officer, because he was I knew nothing about signals. And we looked after the strip, which was purely a strip about 5 miles outside the village of Michinaha, and the troops were coming back up the river, the Irrawaddy, and getting aboard this thing, and we're being evacuated. It's the troops, the wounded, some civilians, if there was room, they got on. And this situation went on, and it got progressively worse, because in the last week, certainly very much so in the last 4 or 5 days, the Jap fighters would come over, the aircraft would come in, just land, and we would have the people, their passengers, whoever they might be, and the wounded and so on, we would have them ready, and as soon as the aircraft, we didn't know when the aircraft was coming in, but we used to get a packet of people ready, so to speak. As soon as the aircraft was on the ground, we used to shovel them aboard. It would turn around and take straight off again, because the Japanese were strafing us, and occasionally, and what used to happen was a problem, when the civilians particularly saw an aircraft coming into land, they would rush out from the sides of just bushes and some kind of gorse and that sort of thing. Not big trees, but I mean it was sort of some sort of cover up to about 6 feet or something like that. Fairly open, but and they would rush out to the side, and the Jap fighter would come down and strafe them. And because some of them got killed. And there was one Sikh doctor there who was marvellous. He used to kind of look after these people. But then as the last 2 or 3 days, it got really untenable. It was very bad. And the last day was absolutely dreadful, because they bombed and strafed us, and there's not a darn thing we could do about it. People were being wounded all the way down, and the dead we used to throw into the bomb craters. The wounded we did what we could for, which was precious little. And one aircraft was caught on the ground by a Japanese fighter, and the crew were just about to, well, they got halfway up the ladder, they were going up through the nose, and this fella came diving down. There was nothing they could do. They couldn't get in to turn the aircraft around or anything. I mean, that would have been suicide. They just had to jump free and rush off and throw themselves on their faces out of the way. And it so happened, I mean, it's just pure, I just happened to be within 20 yards of it, and I was in some sort of hole, I know, and they came down, they strafed this thing like mad, and then they cleared off, and I knew that I had to get into that aeroplane to see if there was anything I could do. And I did get in, and I went up the front, and every single chap had been killed. And they were mostly wounded. I mean, wounded chaps being taken back. And everyone were killed, each and every one.
What kind of an aircraft was that?
That was a Dakota. And that was quite the worst experience I've ever had in my life. Dreadful. And as it so happened, though, we didn't know what to do. You know, we were thinking about, we have to get these chaps out and give them a proper burial and that sort of thing, which was really impossible in these circumstances, when they came over again. And this time they had another go at this aircraft on the ground, set it on fire, and the whole lot were incinerated there and then, which was a blessing, I suppose, really. But it was really horrid. The wounded there, I mean, one poor chap, he was Gurkha, I think, but he was certainly of Indian, or I think he was a Gurkha, and he was out in the open, and his wounds were suppurating like mad, but he was still alive and he was still conscious. The only thing I could do was lift him up and carry him into the shade and give him a drink of water. Nothing I could do otherwise. There was some sisters from Roman Catholic home or something for children. They had arrived with some half dozen, 10 children, something like that. Nothing we could do about it. We just tried to give them some food and, you know. But I did hear afterwards that they had escaped, thank goodness. Now, in the meantime, I had arranged with the warrant officer signals that he would have to break up his... That the brigadier there in charge got me down into his headquarters, and he said, now, you know, they'll be here any time at all. So, but incidentally, during these last 3 days, we were smashing up things. Anything that could be useful to them, we were, you know, breaking up, goodness knows what. And whilst I was with the Brigadier, this was, I think, the day before all this really blew up on the last day, one of his men came up and said, so-and-so, they've pinched the ambulance, they've taken the ambulance. And the Brigadier just said, right, get them, shoot them, bring the ambulance back, just like that. And there's no messing. I mean, you know, I mean, it was absolutely... And he said, then he turned to me and he said, look, your signals unit is the only unit we've got with outside communication with the rest of the world. There's nothing else except that. And he said, any moment now, tell your warrant officer that we have got to break that up too. That it's got to go. It's going to be every man for himself, and that's it. And I then, this was the last day but one, I commandeered some motor vehicles, because some of the civilians used to come up in their cars and leave them there. And normally you sort of said, well, you can break it up or something if you like, take out this, make it, you know, can't be driven. But I commandeered three vehicles, and because I thought, well, we'll use those to escape. That were about, I think there were 17 of us in all, and we got water and I got all sorts of things. I got them stocked, because what I was going to do was to take them up to Superabon, which was up the track, a main sort of road, in the north, right in the northeast corner of Burma, and then we would dispose on, we would then walk across into India, which I forget how far that was, but we never even got there anyway. Because an aircraft arrived, the last one on the, this is now on the, we broke up all the signal stuff, we did all this that we possibly could, and we were all, went through, as I've just described, all this bombing and strafing business, and sorry, my throat gets rather, yes. And this last aircraft arrived at the end of this awful day. It was a Dakota, and he came in just at dusk, and the chap jumped out and he said, come on, you blokes have got to get on. So we said, no, we don't want to, because there's wounded and this, that, and that. And he said, you've got to get on, you're fighting personnel, you'll be court-martialed if you don't, and those are my orders to take you back. And so we got on with just simply the clothes we stood up in, which all of us, I'm sure, we all, I stank to high heaven, because we had nothing. And they flew us out and back to Dinjan in India, and that was there. There was only one thing that stands out, well, apart from all that, which was absolutely horrible, and I never talk about it. I've never talked about it from that day to this, because it was too terrible. But after I'd been there about 6 weeks, maybe a month, 6 weeks, something like that, an aircraft came in, and the squadron leader got off, and he came along and he said, I'm from headquarters so and so, I can't remember where it was, but from some headquarters, and he said, I've been sent over to see how you're getting on, and you know, if you need anything, and so on and so on, you see. And I said, no, I don't think so, I think we're all right, you know, it's going all right. So he said, okay, well, that's good, you know, cheerio. And he got back into the airplane and went away again, and that was fine. I didn't give it another thought. Until I was back in home again into Jinjiang, we went down to Calcutta. I was then involved with trying to get some more clothes and because I'd had nothing, you see. And a few days later, and I was called in, and the chap said, you know, you had this squad leader so-and-so come over to see you, I believe. And I said, yes, that's so. What did he say? I told him. And he said, oh, I see. He said, well, I'm doing a court of inquiry because that officer was sent over to relieve you. He said it was thought that it was too much for a young flying officer to undertake, and we sent the squadron leader. And he went over and he came back again. So he was being court-martialed, which was a matter of no real interest. But so there we were. And then I did various things then. I was on an airfield sighting board next. And
just before you go on to that, yes, I understand it, you'd lost your 45 squadron because they'd been wiped out.
Yeah.
So you never actually joined that. So this group you were with at Michinar was a sort of ad hoc.
That's right. That's right. I still, on paper, belong to 45 group. 45 squadron. Yes, on paper. That up there was a, well, I was hanging, you know, I mean, the air quarters there decided that they wanted somebody at Michinar and they sent me. There was no airplanes to fly, you see, so... Yes, that's right. Okay.
Yes. Sorry, I interrupted you with you going on to the next thing.
Well, I was going on to it because it was about now that I started to get very fed up with this. I mean, I was a good job of work, and I felt that I'd been usefully employed, and I was doing something towards the war effort. But on the other hand, I hadn't flown for some while, and... you know, I felt what I really wanted to do, of course, was to get back to England in Bomber Command. That was what I wanted to do. But and I began at this stage now. When I got back from Michinar, I really felt, you know, well, I'm getting a bit brassed off with this. And then between times, you see, there was nothing to do at all. I should go down to the air headquarters and say, "No, how about it?" And then they said, "For God's sake, go away. We'll let you know when there's something." And the next thing I was put on was this airfield sighting board. This was a small thing. I mean, there was an army colonel in charge who was Indian Army. So, of course, he spoke two or three dialects of Hindustan or Hindi or whatever it is. There was a captain from the REs. There was me from the Air Force, and we had two sepoys. And our brief was to go over to the border of eastern India and northeast India and with Burma and look for sites where there might be a fit for a landing strip, easily made into it with all the supporting, you know, logistics. And which might be of use either to the Japanese or to ourselves. And well, this really, I mean, I could write a book about this. I wish to goodness I did have a diary of it, but in the course of time it went. But it was a most extraordinary business because we would go off. In the station wagon, we started. The great big American station wagon was what we basically travelled in, and we would go off. We'd look at the map and go off to what we thought was a site. We used to stay in the guest houses, which the Indians have in all their villages. I mean, it's just there with a charpoy, but somebody in the village was nominated to kind of look after you or whatever, and. We'd go off and we'd walk, we'd go on bicycles, we would ford rivers, walk through them, and we we went out one, this is just one instance, we went out one morning from, and we set off at about 5 o'clock, just after dawn. We took bicycles down to this place to get across the river. Which the riverman, the chap in his riverboat, his boat took us over. He wasn't scheduled to do so, but we got hold of somebody. You see, with his command of the local language, he could fix up anything. And, of course, he had money. This anyway, cut it all short, his fellow took us over. And, oh, well, prior to this, I don't know that I should say this, but it's, to be honest, the captain in the REs went LMF. He decided he'd had enough of this. And he said he was a sick man and this, that and t'other. And I heard the colonel talking to him when he had him sort of what's name saying, you know, you mustn't do this and all this sort of thing. And this bloke said, oh, yes, I am. I'm a sick man. I'm not fit for this and all this sort of thing. And I must say, it wasn't very pleasant, but there you are. So we got him over to the Irrawaddy and we put him on a boat, one of the hospital boats going up the Irrawaddy back, you know, to India. And that was that. But I'll tell you what happened to him later on, if you'll remind me, if I forget. But this particular, so he'd gone, and this particular morning, the colonel and I set off together. We got across this river, and we went to the other side. It wasn't a very big river. It was quite narrow, actually, no more than this room, I suppose, at the time, although there was plenty of room for it to expand. And it then started to rain. The beginning, when we started this thing, the monsoon period was about to break, and we were told that we were idiots to go on it, because whoever had sent us couldn't have known what they were talking about, because with the monsoons and that sort of thing, it was virtually impossible. And anyway, we went, and we went off, and we went with our bicycles. We took our bicycles across, and we cycled, and we went on all day long. We had nothing at all, looking for this, what's the name. We actually got into the jungle, and I fell off, and oh dear me. But on the way back, and of course it had been pouring with rain the whole time, just emptying it down the whole time. Now, we got back, and we knew it was getting towards dusk, but we could see all right, and we knew that we had to cross through this water, which was right up, it was like a paddy field. It was a, you know, so we started, and we had to hold our bikes above our heads, and we went on, and it was terribly tiring, because it was up round our armpits, and it was soft going, you know, and it was really sapping our energy. The colonel was about 40, I was 22 or 23, and it got to the stage where we could see a line there. We thought, ah, that's the bank up there, you see, so we made for it, and when we got within about 10 feet, we realised that it wasn't. It was just some tall rushes growing up out of it. And the colonel said to me, I can't go any further, Frank. I've finished. And, well, I was damn nearly finished too. But anyway, being a younger man, I took his bicycle, and he kind of took my shoulder, and between us, we kind of encouraged each other. We got through this, and we got up the other side, and then there was a sort of bank running along to the river. We knew this bank was there because we'd come up that way, so we knew we were all right. And do you know, we went round a corner of this bank, and right ahead of us were two tigers. It sounds almost, you know, unbelievable, but they were just playing. And I reached for my gun, and the colonel said, don't, he said. No, he said, keep quite quiet. Don't say anything. Get your hand on your bell, and I'll get it on mine. And when I say go, he said, ring your bell as loud as you can and shout at the top of your voice, which we did. And these things took fright and ran away. And we got back, and the river had swollen right across the thing. So by this time it was dark. And so we said, oh, well, God, we'll have to sit here and wait till the morning. Anyway, the colonel called out something, and he called out again, and then suddenly there was a little hail in return. And this blooming boatman had stayed there and waited for us, which I thought was this Indian, elderly Indian chap, you know. And we got, and then we had to cycle 5 miles back to this rest house, where we simply collapsed. We were absolutely dead. And that was one day, and that was by no means unusual. And the only time the colonel and I ever came to disagreement, because he was a lovely chap, and I really did think the world of him, was on one of them. He said, we ought to go to so-and-so and look at that. And we looked at it, and I said, well, do you think it's worth it? Because this, that, and t'other, you see. And he said, well, possibly not, but I think we ought to go. So we went, and it turned out to be an absolutely disastrous day. It was boiling hot. we had nothing there. This went wrong. Everything possibly went wrong. We got back to this guest house thing that we were going to sleep in. The chap who'd said he would have some food for us, there wasn't any. The mosquito nets were, well, there was one mosquito net that was all right. The other one wasn't, which was mine. I got into the darn thing, and the bed collapsed, the charpoy collapsed. The net came down, it was all torn, and everything was wrong. I was bitten to death all night by these blue.